We do need one mic. Oh, you don't need one more. Are you okay with it? You can use this. Okay.
In Hawaii, then.
Appropriations, hope for finance, economic development. But today is appropriations.
Well, with all your help, you're welcome.
Thanks.
You're a member of this committee.
A special welcome to our guest, Fiji. Thank you very much for your coming. I know that you have spoken to the portfolio committee. The national health. Maybe very good that now finally you're coming to present to Parliament, because there has been a snapshot in our Parliament about it on NHI. The minister kept on saying, no, we'll present policies when you are ready to do that, and Parliament will engage at that time. Now, that time, Kina is here, so you're welcome. Dr. Pleasure, thank you very much for coming. To support us, we always appropriation happy to have you around to assist us every time. Thank you. Honored members, we invited the department today to come and talk to us about how this national health insurance is going to look like. speeches is here to inform us. So now, is when we have, we will be doing it officially because the department has also tabled the green paper. So have to.
If we are going to open the paper, we come and be back to the paper.
We bring this as an to the health of South Africa. When we were working as part of the team with treasury, that was established by the IMC, the DDG, the Mr. Donald, who said that 50 years from now, when we look back, we probably be happy about what South Africa has done as a country. We hold it that it is for that reason that we take the consequences of energy are important, and that at least improve access to health. But access to health is not only physical access, but it's about appropriateness, and it's also about quality. Like quality of drink is a major concern, and probably one of the areas that the health department would like to improve significantly. But it's also going to be an opportunity for us to increase safety provision, and it's premised on principles of equity, where it will ensure that the Russians can access health inquiry, but that it will be affordable and of quality. And it will be not based on social community. We know, Chair, that the South African health system is inequitable, with the privilege to have disproportionate access. And Chair, I would like to cite this example because I think it's repeated to that. If you have access to some form of financial protection, you actually have a choice. You can walk to a nearby GP. You don't have to get into a taxi to go to a faraway clinic or for a hospital. So this presents an opportunity for those who need to access services of a GP nearby to access them and other services without having to walk a long distance. And this chair, if you give us an opportunity, we've actually done what we call polygons and things, where we actually map out how long it takes people to walk to facilities and how long ambulance would take to ferry people from one facility to another, even from their own family. So it's quite clear that there are still access barriers in terms of those systems. And we see this as an opportunity to reduce that problem. We also recognize that the system as it is neither rational nor fair, and that the two-tier system can be improved significantly to address problems of equity. Chair, there are obviously problems on both sides, both in the public and private sector. And the private sector problems, we summarize firstly that funding is allocated through local teams. It can also be through hospital cash loans or out-of-pocket payments. But we know that for those patients that are covered, some of them do not access all services because of the benefit options that are designed by different teams based on the affordability of the cover itself. And it's how the medical teams strategies have been presented historically. But it's also about the subsidies that are provided both by the employer and the state. It's part of also the conditions of employment for some of the employees. For the public sector, which covers a significant population, it's funded through systems, but we know in the public sector that management is a big problem. And this we have confirmed through the work that has done through the DSA, where we assess all the consequences of the management, particularly those of hospitals. But the resourcing of the public sector relative to the size and the burden of this is a major challenge. But there are also maximum resources in the public sector or in the private sector. Yesterday, Chair, we were discussing the burden of from the data that we have, even infants and under five, that was 680 pediatricians in the country. And 50% of those are in the public sector and 50% in the private sector. Now, this is data that was shared with us by the chair who showed one of the confidential inquiries in the infant data. And what is significant is to say that if 16.2% of the population in the private sector has access to 50% of pediatricians, it's quite clear that we only have 50% for the rest of the population. So the question is, how do we access this other resource to reduce the pregnancy? And I think those are some of the problems and challenges that we have to address. And perhaps it may help us to alleviate this problem that we have in the public sector. To successfully implement the healthcare financing mechanism that covers the whole population, such as NHI, there are four key interventions that need to happen in our pregnancy. We need to transform the way the service delivery in the healthcare is designed, in the manner in which services are provided, but also overhaul the entire system and ensure that we improve its management and administration radically. But this must be premised on a comprehensive package that is underpinned by primary health care that has been re-engineered. And Chair, what you are proposing here is that if we say maternal and child health is a key problem, and it's a key indicator not just for health but also a sign of development of the country, and we say we'd like to put investment to respond in that particular way, what we're proposing here is that we'd like to have obstetricians and gynecologists, because currently we know that if we can make a few obstetricians, gynecologists, pediatricians, and some of our anesthetists available at district level, because we've seen that women die before they even reach facilities. We know that they die in our facilities. And if we can make, at district level, we actually have that breakdown of data, and we see that when we want to intervene at that level by making these specialists available at that level, both a pediatrician as well as pediatric nurses. We'd like to make both midwives as well as obstetricians and gynecology. Anesthetists, just as an example, and as well as family physicians. So WASPA may not have a lot of those, but if they within a district, if they cover a significant population within a district, it may help us reduce the burden. We've seen the data for both neonates, we've seen the data for both maternal mortality, and also for under five. Just those three categories, we may be able to intervene, and as part of that, it's really engineered to primary care. But the second factor is about the community health based primary health care that promotes and prevents health problems, and which is the basis of sending teams so that we can empower people to take charge of their own health, but also identify health problems that can be prevented. It may help us alleviate the burden. The WHO report that was a World Health Report that was published in 2008 details three trends that undermine the improvement of health globally. And these they identify as hospital centricity, which has a strong therapeutic focus, fragmentation and approach, which may be related to how programs are designed and how the delivery is organized, and uncontrolled commercialism, which undermines principles of health as a public good. South Africa two-tier system can also be parallel to what WHO identifies as a problem. In the long term, it may not be sustainable, but the cost may be a problem, but its curative means may also add to cost. is the big problem for promoting cannabis. We know today that Alaska has a budget of the NRCB. And next month, there will be a high level meeting that will be convened by head of state to discuss a non-committed disease as a global problem. Now, if an emerging problem in this country, in that much as we have the burden of HIV and AIDS and TB, we also have a problem of non-committed disease. We have a problem, Western case will be convening a meeting on violence and trauma and injuries in November. This is co-hosted with WHO, and you are amongst the country, I looked at the data last night, you are amongst the country that is shown to have a high burden. And it's probably one area that would require a careful attention. Our maternal and mortality, maternal and child mortality rates.
So the government pretend
that they have for the community of the past of the there might be familiar with them. This is what I'm doing. I'm explaining the non-communicable diseases, HIV, TB, maternal and child mortality, HIV, drug as well as injury and violence, which I said there will be a co-hosted conference between the Western Cape and WHO to look specifically at the injury. And then it's a significant burden. And if you look at the virtual map of the high burden countries, it is a significant problem in our country. The other challenge is the distribution of financial and human resources, both between rural and urban, as well as public and private. So I think it's a major problem. If you look at the burden of disease between rural and urban, it's quite significant in urban areas. If you look at the distribution of resources, there is obviously mass distribution. But we know that the cost of healthcare is a problem, and the out-of-pocket payment for some of the people are not covered by medical aid, as well as cost of money. Quality in the public health facilities is a major concern. Cleanliness, we did not share the preliminary data that we have from the 800 facilities that we did until the end of July. As of end of August, we have more than a significant number of facilities. Cleanliness come out as one of the key topics in almost all of them. Followed by safety. Those are the two key problems. The long waiting time, self-attitude, infection control, drug program. Those are common. And in this audit that we are dealing with, these are not just the only areas that we are focusing on. We also have other areas about management, governance, financing, and so on, which will be reporting on very soon. I'll give over to Dr. PV to talk about the cost of healthcare and my future.
As you know, in the private sector, the costs have been really going out of control. And this has resulted in medical scheme premiums being escalated to an extent that many people are unable to actually afford the medical cover. The costs in the public sector have also been escalating, and this has put pressure on the fiscal as well. If we look at the public sector and ask ourselves the question as to what are the drivers of cost, the first one is the composition of employees, and I think the occupation-specific discrimination has put greater pressure on the public health system and the second big driver is pharmaceuticals. We're attempting to use new and innovative ways to procure medicines, and we're not just the antiretroviral agenda we we'll attempt to do that for other areas as well, as we try to get greater savings in the area of pharmaceuticals. In the case of laboratory services, there's challenges around the cost of laboratory services. So some of the issues there is, for example, the National Health Laboratory Services funds the research and training of registrars as well through the service fees that they receive from pharmacies for the tests that they do. So rather than being funded separately, that's attached into the service fee, and that has some pressure on the provincial health budget. And so we're looking at the prices of some of the lab services, where we assume that they're higher than prices in the private sector without taking account of the costs of hospitals. And when we take them off, we actually see that they may actually be more reasonable. The issues around blood and blood products, the irrational use of blood and blood products. The minister usually cites the example where he visited a facility and instead of the facility ordering ferrosulfate tablets, which are applied for anemia, they ordered blood to transfuse patients, which is 10 times more expensive than the ferrosulfate tablets, or the cheapest drug that you get. In terms of health technology and equipment, the quality of the products that we procure, as well as the fact that across the various provinces, there are attempts to try to get facilities to buy these products, and they're not necessarily functioning the way they actually purport it to be. That causes several challenges. In terms of the private sector, I think this graph probably says many stories. The first is that the big drivers in the private sector have been private hospital costs. And then the purple line, if my colors correct, is the cost of specialists. And what you'll notice is that as the cost of private hospitals increase, so have specialists. Largely because in order for specialists to deliver their service, they require private hospitals to do so. So those costs have followed a similar trend. In the case of pharmaceuticals, we have intervened in regulating prices, and you notice that together with other interventions have resulted in the price of medicine actually reducing in the private sector. The other interesting aspect is that general practitioners, for example, who should be the first port of call in the private sector in order to get services, have not insisted on this in a period of time, largely because one is not obliged to go to a GP first before going to a specialist in practice. People just go directly to specialists, which is very different from many developed country markets, for example, where you cannot walk into a specialist room without being referred by a GP. But here, GPs have effectively been bypassed, which means that the cost of the system is much higher. Because specialists do lots of investigations, etc., which may not have always been necessary. And then the result of which these drive up costs as well. So just to depict this in graphical form, hospitals make up about 30%, 37% of the expenditure in the private medical sector. Specialists make up 22%, and the pharmaceuticals make up 17%. GPs, as I pointed out, make up 7%. The allied professions, 8%, and that includes the other professions that are in terms of affordability of medical scheme contributions, a number of medical schemes have either collapsed or replaced under curatorship or merged. Gradual reduction. The schemes have reduced from 180 in the year 2001 to 102 in 2009, and we're currently sitting at about 99 currently. That's largely because of the pressure that schemes are under to actually fund the cost of private health care. They have difficulty containing the cost because they effectively have to pay whatever providers bill to them. The only other option available to them is to basically pass on those to patients who pay them as co-payments, which doesn't help patients in any way. So the premiums have been in excess of CPIX for many years now, and that has really put pressure on the community. In terms of NHI, I think it's important to recognize that the discussions around NHI have been around for a long time. They actually started in 1928, if we go back into history, and was developed over time from then. And there have been several discussions around how we could introduce a national health insurance. These have largely been faced with several challenges in implementation going forward. We hope and we really said that this will be a time in history when we actually are able to achieve something for South Africa in the introduction of national health insurance.
Amen.
One of the principles of NHI, firstly, the right to access, so that everybody should have equal rights to the access of care. The second area is our social solidarity, meaning that the young should subsidize the old, the rich should subsidize the poor. Social solidarity that goes with that as South Africa, as an entire community, which exists in many other markets, is something that we need to achieve here, rather than the current approach of fragmented risk pools in different medical fields. The issue around equity, those that have the greatest need and least able to afford access to healthcare should be given the opportunity to have equal access. The NHI should be effective in the delivery of care so that it deals with the burden of disease of the country so that it improves the morbidity and mortality of South Africans. The services that are delivered to South Africans should be appropriate in that they should be delivered in a manner that is in keeping with the communities and the expectations of healthcare in South Africa. They should be effective in that it should deliver a particular outcome that we intended to do. It should be efficient, and we should attempt to achieve the maximum output for the investment that we make. And it must be affordable for the country. We cannot have a national health insurance which is effectively burgeon over here and puts pressure on the general fiscal system. So the objectives of NHI is to provide improved access to quality of health services, irrespective of whether South Africans are employed or not, to pool the risk and funds so that there's equity and solidarity, and this is achieved through a single fund. So one fund would be able to pool the funds and also pool the risks that the health is related to all South Africans into one fund and use that to buy services from all South Africans. And to procure these services using the financial resources that are available in the fund, and strengthen the under-resourced, trained public sector and improve the health system's performance in the public and private sector. The question is always, well, what are the benefits of NHI? Well, in terms of the socio-economic benefits, the work that was done together with the National Treasury has shown that we can actually have increased output as we have healthier people that are able to work more effectively. Their productive time is increased, so they have fewer days of work. They have a longer lifespan. Their life expectancy improves as well. And they have increased work life and savings as a result of increased life expectancy and increased workforce activity. Now, the WHO has a very interesting way of describing national health insurance through this diagram, which is very helpful in appreciating the concept. If we look at the x-axis, which is the population and who is covered, and we ask the question, well, who do we want to cover? And the plan is to cover every South African. So clearly we have to extend the blue area to include all South Africans within the area. Then the question is, which services will be covered? And if you look at the y-axis, you see we need to extend services to make sure that all South Africans have access to the same services. And then if you look at the other axis, which is to reduce cost sharing and fees, so that South Africans, when they're accessing the services, are not faced with these co-payments and fees that act as barriers to them accessing care, particularly the poor households who may actually not access services because they are challenged by the fees that they have to pay at the point. In terms of population coverage, what we're proposing is all South Africans and legal permanent residents will be covered. Short-term residents, foreign students and tourists must obtain compulsory travel insurance, just like when we travel to many countries, we need to have travel insurance to do so, and we expect others traveling to South Africa to have the same cover. refugees and the sign speakers covered in line with the Refugees Act of 1998 and international human rights instruments ratified by the state also have to be covered. But the NHR fund is not intended to cover, that will have to be covered for just it's very important that we re-engineer the health system before we introduce NHR because clearly there are several challenges with the health system which we spoke about. And the first point of entry in terms of this is the primary health care service. In terms of primary health care services, we're proposing three streams. The first stream is the district-based clinical specialist support team that will support and deliver primary health care programs at district level, and the specialist team with which you outlined is the gynecologists, the pediatricians, the anesthetists, the family physician, as well as the midwife. Then we'll have the school-based primary health care services, where children at school level will have access to a primary health care nurse, so diseases are identified early and able to be treated rather than having to wait for them to present health facilities. And then municipal ward-based primary health care agents who will be able to go out into communities and educate communities and identify diseases before they're actually breaking out into large pockets where we then need to deal with them as an epidemic or pandemic. In terms of the clinical specialist support team that I spoke about, basically this would involve an obstetrician and gynecologist, pediatrician, family physician, anesthetist, midwife, and the primary health care professional. The role of the team is basically to support the district in the management of the high burden disease, particularly given our challenges around maternal and child health. These specialists would be able to support the medical officers and other clinicians at the district level, be able to give them the appropriate support so that these patients don't have to wait to be referred to secondary, tertiary, quaternary level care in order to get that treatment, largely because these physicians are now available at the district level. In terms of school health services, these services will include health promotion, prevention, and curative health services to address the needs of school-going children. These will include screening of children for various conditions. Immunization as well is included in the program so that diseases are prevented and identified early rather than having the municipal ward-based primary health care agents. These are a team of PHC agents who will be deployed in every municipal ward. We're proposing at least 10 people. These PHC agents will be deployed per ward, and each team will be headed by health professional who will be responsible for supporting these teams, and we hope that we can do this depending on availability. So each member of the team will be allocated a certain number of families. The responsibility is to educate those families, identify disease conditions within those families, refer them to the health center early in the disease, and make sure that we have a good handle on the progress of disease in the community rather than having to wait in our facilities in a hospice-centric approach as a WHO picture, which is a challenge for many.
Any special qualifications for those people?
For the
agents.
For the agents. There is a training program that the agents will have to undergo in order for them to be able to educate communities around prevention as well as prevention. So the healthcare benefits as we we intend to deliver. This is not meant to be an exhaustive list, because it's very difficult to provide an exhaustive list within a slide. So what we've tried to do is group the benefits as we understand them in the health system. So this would be the primary care services, prevention, promotion, curative, as well as the community outreach that I spoke about, as well as the inpatient and outpatient hospital care that is available on the NHR, prescription medicines, emergency care, which includes ambulatory emergency care, mental health services, oral health services, basic vision care and vision correction, and then appropriate technologies for diagnosis and treatment, including assistive devices. There are many things that's put into the list, but put into the slide. In terms of hospital benefits, you may have noted that we have introduced a designation of hospitals, a redesignation of hospitals, and we classify hospitals and identify the criteria which hospitals fall into, whether they're district, regional, tertiary, central, and specialized. And linked to that is the appropriate qualification skills that the CEOs should have in order to be able to actually run such facilities. So that has recently been published as well. In terms of accreditation of providers, there is a draft bill on the Office of Health Standards Compliance, and this will be tabled in Parliament soon. This is an independent body that has effectively three units: an inspection unit, an ombudsperson, and a certification of health facilities. All facilities will have to be certified before they're actually eligible for consideration by the NHR contract. In terms of payment for providers, at primary healthcare level, we're proposing a risk per capita payment for accredited and contracted providers in the public and private sector, as opposed to the current arrangement of fee-for-service. At hospital level, we're proposing a global fee and to move away from the case-based mechanism where currently, for example, if you're in a private hospital, you may note that you can charge for every swab and catheter and syringe, etc. This approach basically requires the facility to charge a global fee, and they become more responsible about the kind of charges that they have and the way they manage that situation. The unit of contracting will be the district health authority, which will be given responsibility for contracting within the NHS. They'll be supported by the fund clearly at sub-national offices to manage these contracts with accredited providers. The accreditation will involve quality standards as well as the accreditation in terms of the cost and the performance in terms of NHS. And these providers the performance of these providers will be monitored. The fiscal funding mechanism, we broadly identify three areas: the fiscus, the employers, as well as individuals. The revenue base should be as broad as possible so that we have several revenue schemes to achieve low contribution rate. We've also to generate sufficient funds to supplement the general tax allocation. Our plan is to try and ensure that whatever individuals contribute to the NHI is not any more than what they're currently contributing to medical schemes. So their contribution to the NHI should not in any way put households in a negative situation versus what they currently are for the services that they're getting. The role of co-payment.
I hope I understand. I don't hope I understand this, but I think it's important.
If you say this as VA.
In terms of the role of co-payment, we would prefer not to have co-payments in the health system, largely because co-payments are a barrier to access, particularly to poor households. However, there are circumstances where we will need co-payments. One of the circumstances is where people decide to deviate from protocols and guidelines as we define them in the NHI, or where somebody decides that they want expensive spectacle frames, Gucci frames, and the like, which clearly cannot be funded in terms of the NHI. And they would then have to pay for that for the co-payment. Where a person decides to go directly to a quaternary level service provider as opposed to going through the referral system, which is expensive to go directly to a quaternary level care. And also where health services are utilized by people who are not insured, such as tourists, for example. In terms of the costing, we estimate that in the year 2025, that the cost would be approximately 255 billion. I think it's important to say that these are indicative costs. They are estimates of what we think it would be. We are planning to do pilots, and we will refine this costing as we learn more about what is going to drive the cost of the jobs of energy. But looking into the future and the best information we have currently, that's what we're projecting. You will notice that we've divided the cost into non-AIDS costs and AIDS costs, given that HIV is such a big component of the health budget currently, particularly in terms of ARVs and other treatments. There are also other costs relating to the administration of NHI, and we've kept the NHI administration to 3% of the maximum when it's fully operational, so that we can ensure that the NHI authority is efficient in the delivery of the services. Because one of the challenges in a single payer system is that administration costs just burgeon and put great pressure on the customers. Often the question is asked, well, what will happen to medical schemes? So medical schemes will continue to exist side by side with NHI. They will continue to provide benefits like they're currently doing within the provisions of the Medical Schemes Act. Our sense of the way the market would move is that the majority of medical schemes will move into a top-up situation, largely because people will get a reasonable level of cover under NHI, only for things that they think they would like additional cover from that they'll be buying top-up.
Perhaps I can now say what is it that we envisage next year. I would like to start by saying, Chair, the process of consultation and engagement of the public and stakeholders and consider that is important, and that the fact that it's also a part of this engagement is for us to start the pilot next year, so that we can address some of the indicative figures that have been presented to us. We were proposing that we have 10 districts that will be selected for the pilot, but the selection criteria will be informed. The preliminary work that you are currently engaged in, there are two streams of work that are underway at the moment. One is that we're assessing the capacity of the district. Like I said, as earlier, that we're busy with the district health expenditure review. And the data from those expenditure reviews will give us a sense of the capacity of the district. But we're also looking at other aspects of the individual district. But what is important for each of the districts is the burden of disease, the ability of the health system to respond. But within the district, there are also facilities. And the second stream of work that is underway is audits that have been conducted. And this is the work that is done by a consortium of five partners, the Health Systems Trust, MRC, Medical Research Council, HIS, which is responsible for district health information system development, as well as other two partners that are working with this consortium. We have so far preliminary data that has been validated for 876 facilities. That is as at end of July. End of August, that will be set to over 1,000. What we intend to do, Chair, as of the 1st of October, with the support from the European Union,
October 2011.
Is to, and this work was being with the technical assistant unit town in Treasure. They have actually helped us to help also for people to identify access in the country on finance and management on in different areas. Now we're working with this team in Treasury to set up teams that will go out as a central partner with donor support to go back to those facilities where we have identified major deficiencies. So there's two streams of work. The first is on quality-related problems that have been identified.
Mm-hmm.
And on quality, the idea is to prepare those facilities mainly to comply with the standards, the norms and standards that will be used in future by the Office of Standard Compliance when the Act is
passed. The
standard. We will make them available. The second stream is about health systems performance in facility. It is about management, finance, it is the service delivery aspect as well as the health indicators. We will use that as a basis of identifying those facilities that are in place of need. We're hoping that we'll send teams based on those reports. So as the estimate that we have, because I will refer to that later, is that we will be getting those reports and then we use the reports to send teams to go back to the facilities to assist the facilities to be at a certain level of readiness. In addition, then we send other teams to help the district to prepare them for the next year. We're still working on the criteria for choosing the district, but our view is that it would be problematic just to select the well-performing district because we need an opportunity to intervene, particularly in those areas where the value of the business is. And we see this as an opportunity to respond to the high burden of the case. During that week, we will be working with Treasury to go back again to cost, to understand what the benefits are and the coverage, and to go back again with the aspects to help us look at the costing model and the time itself. And that's the preliminary work, Chair, that I should highlight. Firstly, the CEO assessment the minister has actually consulted all the CEOs, all the team managers, all the necessary managers in consultation with them to inform them that we need to firstly review the hospital to come up with a policy on how hospitals must be managed, the appropriate flow and appropriate competencies for management of these hospitals and districts. We also have a chair regulations on revenue retention. So we are hoping that because the consultation process has been concluded, that we will be able link to the designation to propose which hospital is at this stage, and this will have to be in consultation with Treasury, which hospital should retain revenue so that they can use better the basis of starting their operations. But it's right that we have to carefully sit on and sit with Treasury and further refinement. We have brought in access to the DRC because one of the things that I think Dr. Peter will explain is that some of the courses will inform us about how the procedures are costed and how claims can be made and so on. And the codification that is currently used, the one is on ICD-10, which is the disease codification scheme that is used. But we also have other systems of codification of the procedures. Now, the public sector has not necessarily adopted that codification scheme, so we have to look at how it's going to be introduced in the public sector. The third is the codification that we've always had, but it's not utilized fully. is the qualification of medicine. In the private sector, they call those life codes. So there are different classes of codes that I use that facilitate the manner in which claims for collection of revenue can be made. And we're hoping that this work will be completed before the end of this year. We referred to the PC re-engineering earlier, and I'm pleased to say, Chair, that some of the provinces have already moved faster. On the 7th of August, Western Cape has already advertised for this specialist that has been secured. Now, what we were suggesting, particularly with the specialist, pediatrician, obstetrician, so that there is equity, because our fear, Chair, is that when the other goes out, the specialists are likely to go to urban areas. We may not be able to attract them in rural areas. So we're trying to find a mechanism by which we can have a system where we coordinate activities between provinces so that we rotate them, we can go to areas where the bandwidth is the highest. And this is what we'd like to do. So within a few weeks, we'll share the policy and the approaches and so on, so that the party can know more or less what is intended. The second chair is about the district health profile. This is a work in progress. We just done preliminary work. Soon we'll be finishing work on the district health expenditure review. We finished 30 districts. We're busy with the remaining districts. We finished 30.
Yeah, I mean the remaining.
Well, the remember we aligned our district with the municipality and local government. So we'll, I would say it's 22, if I use the previous number. It could be less, but these are the numbers. The second I refer to the health facility, what we intend to do, Chair, if we are allowed, and you are in discussion with the provinces, is to see whether we can make some of the information publicly available of the outcome of the audit so that we go back, we intervene, and then we can then come back and then say what is it that we plan to intervene and then show the results of the intervention. Provincial quality plans, there are improvement plans that provinces are busy working on. And this is based on self-assessment, because we share some self-assessment tools with the provinces, just on quality, for them to say what is it that they think. But we know that self-assessments are somehow sometimes subjective, but we recognize that in addition to the self-assessment, we are also having this audit as a new method and approach to validating the data on quality specifically. Chair, based on the parliamentary processes and the public hearing, the Office of Health Standards Compliance Bill has gone to the state law advisor, it will be then sent to the parliamentary process. You'll see then what the outcome of that process will be. But hopefully, if the Office of Standards Compliance is established early next year, then they can start going back to these facilities where we've introduced including the employee and inspect and also certify them as to whether they meet the standards of compliance and standards of quality or not. The service package and pilot team, we've got a team that has been instrumental in developing the trust in London. They are helping us to work on the service package. And the reason is that within a district, we want to see how the service package will be. And that service package is going to be key in determining whether the NHI will be affordable. Because if you say everybody will access all services and will get everything, and you say you will cover everybody, obviously it's not going to be affordable. But as to how that service package is designed, is going to be informed by the pilot. Again, the infrastructure and equipment plan, the chair will come back to you. What we've done, we've looked at whether in terms of the motion deputy chair. We wanted to see how long it takes to travel, how long it takes ambulances to ferry people to facilities. And one of the things that we're trying to do with the infrastructure plan is to see whether where the clinics are currently located and for the future locations of the facilities, whether it's appropriate. And we would like to use that as a basis of health facility planning. So we've actually done a mapping of all the facilities and we've located that data. And at an appropriate stage, if you allow us, we'll come and go to you and present all of that data. The human resource strategy is out for comments. We'd really appreciate the comments. We would like to have a proper modeling and projection. This is for all 27 occupational classes, but we didn't just limit it to the 27 occupational classes, and we also recognize that there are also support personnel, clerical staff, administrative staff, and others that should also be taken for. So that when we talk about HR, human resource for health strategy, it's all encompassing and it's comprehensive. We obviously have challenges with data because PESAL is not reliable, but we try to use some of the data from the statutory council. That is also another area of challenge because the people register, but they're not interested. Some are business people, they're in business, they're no longer practicing, some are overseas. So the data that we have, you know, we have to actually collect data so that it's accurate and so on. But equally,
some are in parliament.
Yes. And we work actually. We've has done reviews over a number of years. We've also gone back to engage them on this data. Equally, there is not in this country a reliable source of data on each other because we've never done a systematic count of who is infected and where at any point in time. And I think this is what we want to resolve to talk about the data. Piloting, I've already said a lot, Chair, but the timelines and business at an appropriate time. I think, Chair, because the green paper is about comment and about stakeholder engagement. What we've done, we've actually compiled a list of all the stakeholders. And we have come up with a program for both processes. So the HR strategy, we're meeting all stakeholders in different groups. This week we'll be meeting labor, last week we're meeting statutory council, next week we'll be meeting all professional associations. So we'll be meeting different stakeholders just to get their input, their views, their guidance, and so on. Equally for NHI, we set up again different stakeholder meetings. And we'd like to do that in provinces, we'd like to do that in communities. We would really like to get every South African giving us input and guiding us. Those who use services, those who pay for services, those who are providers of services across board. I think it will enrich this process and it will improve our policy process and input. We've also invited international people. Those countries that have gone to work, we know that you can't just transpose any experience of any particular country. We've got experts based on advice from Treasury, experts from Netherlands. We've got experts from Thailand who introduced a 30 vaccine, a low-cost national health insurance in Thailand, which has actually improved universal coverage. We're working with a team from the UK. The EU will be making available some of the access to websites. So we'll be getting those access in the country just to share experiences, to guide us, and so on. So it's going to be a very interactive process. But we'll also be consulting local experts, in particular, as a group, a GPT, that will be giving us an input. Like advised that the district, especially the team, has finished the preliminary work, and their report will be read very soon. And we finished the audit of all the community health workers. Like I said, we've got a lot of health promotion practitioners. We've got a list of all of them across the country. We'd like them to be part of the team when we set up the 10 team members of the health promotion practitioners, environmental health practitioners, community health workers, so that as we start the pilot, we have to be in place. The job description of the specialist has been finalized. We are hoping that will be publishing this out the advert. And it will work jointly with the, our experts and provincial heads to start the selection process. The chair, I would like to say that as part of the allocation, and I would like to recognize Mr. Fletcher, part of the funds is just for this. MPES pilot includes funding for this one for the specialists to reduce maternal and child mortality for the PAC team for this MPES pilot. So we'd like to see whether we can see in some of those resources in the appointment and allocation of the service for the different districts. Yes, I think the HR strategy will not be set in this year for now. But we are aware that the film of the post in the public sector is going to cost quite a lot of money. But we have to check whether we should make use of the private sector, services, in particular the GPs, if they are acceptable for our community. So all of that is working because we need to go back cost and also look at what are the options and methods we have. Yes, the data making of districts have already referred to this. I don't know if you can answer. I will stop here. Thank you very much.
Are we done?
But, well, I can go back and keep this here, but I earlier. Yes, I think I've done that. Then I have to now go and talk about basic indicators and areas of focus. That is the big thing.
Thank you very much, CG. I think for us as the committee of association, we're finding it very comprehensive and educative. I'm good with them. But I think we're finding very educative. And it's good that the portfolio committee colleagues are here. The chapter is well done. We said to colleagues, our please there you are. Now it looks like I think the presentation was very clear. There are no questions. So. Okay, I've got what looks to me not in model.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Maybe the Portfolio Committee on Health should have invited this committee, but so that it gets, you know, at that time. Thank you for the presentation. It's good that your finance gurus are here. Can you just enlighten us as to how much is the budget? traffic and how much is the budget that you have in preparation for NHI, bearing in mind that that revitalization was the beginning, but how much budget is in place for that from the people? Maybe the finance gurus will respond to that one, and you might respond to that one as well. Thank you, Jason.
The finance budget for the way that is being done. Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I have a few questions. But I think, firstly, and for this committee, what is important is the funding aspect. Because mm-hmm. that's what we are interested in. How do we assist this particular scheme to move forward so that the objective that they've set out can be met? And for my own self, I think this is one of the major milestones since the advent of democracy in this country. It's a very, very major step which we as a party would support in terms of what it aims to achieve. However, there are a number of filling of the blanks that will be required between now and 2025. Chair, it reminds me of my Secretary General the other day was reminding me of his late father who had an ailment. The private doctor told him, I would recommend you take him to a public facility. He said, because you'll get better care, you won't get a hotel, but you'll get good medical care. And that's exactly what he did. And he says, as his father was on the wheelchair in the public hospital in Durban, there were doctors just attending to him, doing blood samples and everything else. And I know, and you all know, if you have to go to a private hospital, before they even attend to you, there'll be a million forms, and do you have medical aid, do you have this, and do you have that. So I think this is going to be a major step for those people that cannot afford medical care. We are fortunate, I think all of us around here, we have people with medical aid, we can walk in and be treated. So it's certainly a step in the right direction. However, the question on costs. We were given costs that run up to 225 billion rand to 2025. What I'd like to know, Chair, from the department, is this an all-inclusive cost? And a cost to whom? Is it a cost to fiscus? Is it a cost that would arise from income that you would derive from ordinary people, that income that goes into the fiscus? And does this cost also take into consideration what the fiscus is already contributing? For example, if I don't know what the budget of health is at the moment, but is this in addition to, and how will that be sort of taken care of? Then I think Ufuze, the Honorable Norway, asked a question about the pilots. Who will fund the pilots? And is there funding for these pilots as we move forward? Chairperson, I think one of the major challenges is going to be also for the department is the budgeting system that they have at the moment. I mean, it's common knowledge that the health services in this country are not up to scratch in terms of the amount of money that's allocated for health. So maybe at some stage we need to know what is the per capita spending on health services from the private sector and the public sector, so that we can assess as we move forward. And is there going to be a special task team that's going to drive this NHI from now until it's successfully implemented? When we had the World Cup, Soccer World Cup, there were task teams including Tom, Dick and Harry. Right? Now, is there going to be such a thing here? So that cabinet members are involved, not Tom Dickinelli here, cabinet members are involved, NGOs are involved, private sector people are involved, so that there is this momentum and constant reporting to the general public of how the NHI is progressing. Obviously, they're going to be, you know, there's going to be uphills and downhills as we move ahead. But I think we need some assurance that if money is allocated from the fiscus, that money is going to be used efficiently, and that you're going to have all the doctors that you require. Because I was reading an article this morning in the paper where
We are short of doctors. You know, what are you going to do to bring doctors into the public sector? Is there going to be incentivization? What is the department going to do to work with other departments? Man, DG mentioned environmental health. Because, you know, you get sick because of the air you breathe and the food you eat. I mean, those are the two reasons you get sick. And a lot of it is hereditary. Now, you know, you go to a place like Durban. There's sulfur dioxide all over, right? People are getting sick, asthmatic, and all sorts of things. You go to informal settlements, unhygienic conditions. So what is going to be a comprehensive plan that the department is going to put into place to prevent people from getting sick in the first place through no reason of their own? I'll stop there.
I think that we have asked lots to but then colleagues in would like to ask more questions. I will let on stop.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you for the presentation, DG. Just on a light note, I must say that you start off your introduction. You say the introduction of an innovative system of healthcare financing. I've never thought that tax is an innovative system, the taxation of people, but in any case, that's just on a light note. But that is the only way in which you're going to get the money, because you're going to have to tax people. That is unfortunately the case. And that is the one thing that worries me, and now I get to the serious side of it. How much is that tax going to be? Is it going to be based on a percentage? Who's going to pay it? Because you also want to, obviously, and quite directly, cater for those people that don't work, that haven't got the money to actually pay something to work. So somebody is going to pay for it, and how much are they going to pay for it? Because, you know, it's something we don't know. Now, the other thing that worries me, Chair, is that, you know, we say that there is, in terms of slide 5, we have currently got poor management systems and oversight, especially hospitals. And what we're trying to do now is we're going to chuck more money into a bad system. And I don't know whether that is the solution, whether we shouldn't get our ducks in a row first before we start with pumping more money into a bad system. And you know, we do require quite correctly, as DG said, a radical change of administration and management, and rectifying that specifically, which, you know, before we can go into the next hire. Otherwise, it will be a case of, you know, a car having a flat tire, and what we're doing is deflating the other three tires instead of fixing the tire that we've got that's deflating. Chair, just one or two more things on the slide. On the school health services and the municipal ward systems, where are those people going to be housed in the school? You say it's a team. I don't know what a team consists of at a school. Is it 5 people, 10 people? You know, what is that team consisting of? And how many, people is going to be in the team? And what are they going to consist of? What are they going to do? And where are they going to be housed? And the question that then comes to mind is, you know, if we're going to have a municipal ward-based primary health, they form part of the same group of people or same team. Because if you're going to have 10 people per ward, you know, there seems to be a thumbsuck of 10 people per ward. Now, you know, a ward in Cape Town or Johannesburg consists of 20,000 people. In Georgia, it consists of 3,000 people. You know, so how, why do you still have the same number of people for a ward? So, you know, it just sounds funny to me, and I think it's overinflated. In any case, the other one I asked about how much it's going to cost. Now, you say medical schemes will continue to exist side by side with NHI. If we take the example of Palmaid, for instance, you know, we're all members of Palmaid here. You know, will we still pay fully for Palmaid and then also make a contribution to NHI on top of that? And how much will that contribution be? And I think the other question I want to ask is about the pilot phase that's been asked. Okay, thank you, Joe. Let's stick to that question.
Thank you, Chair, for giving the opportunity to ask some questions, and thank you, DG, for the presentation again. I just want
to say from the outset, I don't think anybody disputes the fact that we need to improve healthcare. No, you can try this one. We need to improve healthcare in our country. And how we get from where we are now to accessible quality healthcare for all, I think we may have different views, and I think we should be open to people's different views as well. I just want to say that as an outset, as a preamble. Now, the DG's talked a lot about quality management and finances, and even if just take the word NHR out of the debate. That should all be happening as a matter of course. The improvement of management of hospitals, which people have been appointed chair throughout the country for political reasons, not on qualifications often. And the DG knows my favorite. I won't raise the issue but of the CEO of Fair Hospital, but that was a classic example of who should not have been employed in the first place. As far as quality is concerned, the Office of Standards Compliance should have been established 8 years ago by law. Still hasn't been. Okay, now we're getting a bill this week, I believe, in Parliament to deal with it, but I'm just giving you some background because it's not on the Health Committee. And as far as finance is concerned, when you have three provinces which are basically bankrupt, Gauteng, Eastern Cape, and KZN. I mean, KZN owes 3.5 billion rand. You know, that just gives you some indication of where health is at the moment. It has to be improved. There's no doubt about it. Okay. So, I just wanted to have that background. So I just want to ask some questions to the DG. Just on slide 21, that block again. Right, if you all want to look at it. The indication here is that not everyone has access to healthcare in South Africa. But everybody does have access to healthcare in South Africa. Any poor person in any rural area can go to hospital and get medical treatment for free. So everyone, we actually have a national health system currently in the country. Slide 21, the block. I'm just waiting for the... Have you got it? Okay. Did you hear what I said? Mm-hmm. Everyone has access to health care in this country. So to give the impression that some people are excluded from health care, I think it's misleading the numbers. What is of concern is the quality of that health care, which you rightfully said, which we have to improve. And it doesn't need a national health insurance per se to do that. And the accessibility, getting facilities where people are, which hasn't been done. And I'm glad to hear the DG's finally, although she's new, the department, I should say, not the DG, is doing mapping of where facilities are and where they're needed. So I just want to, state that. Then as far as the Y axis is concerned about expanding services, the dark block within the big block is supposed to be where basically the private health sector is currently. My question to the DG is, if you're going to expand the services in that Y-axis, what additional services over and above what the medical aids are offering now are you going to be offering in the NHS? That's it. Then, as far as the funding is concerned, you give it a figure of 255 billion. Now, is that in 2012 terms or 2025 terms? Because it's out here in 2012 terms. Right? That's 255 billion. Were you with me? I don't know if you are. Okay. And is that, in the green paper you talk about 6.2% of GDP, is that 6.2% of GDP currently or in 2025? Okay. Now, you talk about individuals will be, no one that's on private Medicaid currently will be expected to pay more than what they can do. But then you're assuming that voluntary contributions by individuals can be then sort of just taxed by government. Government can just unilaterally assume that they can take that money from individuals anyway, who are voluntarily paying for additional services. And on what basis do you assume that? If I may ask. Okay. And then the shortfall, even if you... Actually, you and I, we pay for medical aid. Right? Okay. It's voluntary. We don't have to do it, but it's voluntary. We do it over and above. Because of the state of the public health system. I don't think you and I, I certainly would not, but I've just said it to the DG, go to a public health facility. But I would like that they would have a choice between public and private. But what I pay to Medicaid is voluntary. Now, what the department is suggesting is that that voluntary payment that I give to Medicaid will be another additional tax that I will have to pay. And I'm asking on what basis are they making that assumption? All right? Then let's just for argument's sake, the 255 is 2012 figures. So you have the 101 billion that the department currently has, and you have the 90 billion that private sector pays, which you assume you're just going to get, right? Nationalisation of the private sector basically. That gives you about 191 billion, which leaves you a shortfall of 66 billion. So, I mean, it has been asked, where are you going to get the extra 66 billion in today's terms? Right. You also
talk
about,
yeah? And I think that you must protect
with
the fact. They never spoke about nationality. They spoke about existing learning parallel. So that the private or the credit would still be there.
Yes, Mr. Chair, maybe because I've got maybe at a more advantage than you, and I do apologize. But the department has talked about using the 90 billion from the private sector to put in check in that fund.
Okay.
Then as far? Yeah, okay. Then you also talked about social solidarity. But we do have social solidarity. Currently, everyone that pays tax to a government, it goes to a central fund, and the government of the day, based on their own priorities, allocates money to each department. That's social solidarity. You have the rich subsidizing the poor rich. Which is right. There's nothing wrong with it. What we do need is more efficiency of our money and our spending. Then just on the other, there's no number here, I can't see it. Just about the district health authority will be given the responsibility of contracting. Now, if they're going to have that responsibility of contracting the districts, each, no matter how many there are, why then have a central fund? It just seems to me that you're having, why doesn't the department just have the fund? This new central fund is at a national level, and we still don't know how transparent and accountable it's going to be. You know, but Vibidia has made the management of this fund, but why have a central fund that is restricted in purchasing healthcare? And why can't the department run it? Because if you have a central fund, I don't see much role to the department. Perfect. It reduces the need for a national department. Okay, thank you very much, Chair.
Can I just add something on top of Mr. Waters' report? The Secretary. You know, if you are a member of medical aid, I think it's the minister that also said, you know, the fact that you top up, if you continue with your medical aid, you will not be entitled to the deduction which you get for medical aid, you know, in terms of the income tax. Rebate, you're not going to qualify for the
United
States.
Now, just a few questions, I think the number. That's number 13, Chair. The DG, thanks once again for a comprehensive. No, let me start from number 11. Number 11, The DG has all these things that which are problematic in the public infection, blah blah. But I would have thought, Chairperson, that the DG would have used this opportunity for the state, if you like, to tell us that these things have been addressed. The long wait times have been reduced from 62 by 90%. The infection. I'm saying the DG I thought he would have used that opportunity to tell us that these things have been addressed. The reason why I'm saying so, Chairperson, these are management issues. Whether there is NHI or not, these are management issues which you get to address yesterday. You know, yes, maybe as a problem today, going forward in trying to address or to implement the NHI, these things are there. But my point is, Chairperson, because of their nature, these are mainly management issues, you know, staff attention, you know, the management issues. People should adhere to what of the period. I mean, it's not even a matter for discussion at this level. I'm saying, however, this space should have been used to tell me that these issues have been addressed by now. Because, Chairperson, you know, it goes to the same issue. You know, this morning I was reading an article by the DG about the question. She just had to do that. That is, adequately now that the problem is that we don't know how many health practitioners out there have. Some were saying 11,000 doctors, the DG was saying 15,000, some are disputing that. Okay, it's a management issue. You know, it reminds me, Chairperson, if you can allow me, of one department is charged of looking for our property. She's all over the world. 17 years down the line, they cannot account for their property.
They cannot
account
for their property. Then she has, what do you call it? People must just do their jobs. Why a department cannot know how many doctors they do have 17 years down the line? It's just not it.
But the second one, Chairperson, will be on slide 13. This is interesting for me because, again, we are talking here, Chairperson, about the cost drivers in the public sector. There are so many things, compensation to MDD, we remember, pharmaceutical. A lot has been mentioned about the state pharmaceutical company. Is that the policy of the government, or is it under discussion? Because I would like to know more about this, because, you know, state company, as we all know them, you know, it raises those bears, you know. Here again, there's a department here which is a lot of deficiencies. They want to bring in the state pharmaceutical company, a very big company, and the capacity to run the company effectively. I'm saying ahead about this, I'm not a health funny, but is there anything, is there any policy, is it under the discussion at a departmental level, or is still being discussed at a political front? The last one, quickly, Chair, is like 35. Again, talking about those speakers there, speakmen, you know. But the last one, the 255 billion. What is the benchmark of that? What are you benchmarking this with? This projection, where does it come from? It's based on what? Who did the study and where? And like, yeah, I want to use the word benchmark as an example of yes, we have gone to Mexico and we have studied their model. This is what's happened, and Mexico is supposed to have more or less the same population as ours. So what are you benchmarking this? Where does this figure come from?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
This is
maybe very simple.
Oh, okay.
We cannot
not talk about our system. Talking about our system, there has been no primary health care for those that have been historically disadvantaged in South Africa. And the unfortunate fact is that most of us who talk in the papers, who talk in the media, are those who believe in this or this and citizen, and are those who are benefiting from what is happening. And those who are not benefiting are not actually getting what is happening. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that the debate is still to another direction, not the direction that we'd like it to have. Mm-hmm. And in fact, this is just something that has been brought. And probably one will be asking, now that you have presented this situation, which I come back to later, one should be saying, do I agree with it or don't I agree with it? And the nitty gritty will come later as to how this thing is going to work out. But the first thing is to agree whether this principle is this the right principle or is this wrong principle. If we feel that it is the wrong principle, then we bring something that is going to be good. And the other part which really worries me is that we are talking about hospitals. And if you look at the private healthcare industry, it's all about hospitals. If it has no primary healthcare at all, it talks about hospitals and that's what it does. So I think what we are doing, we should really look at how we should handle this thing so that it has the benefits that we want it to have. Not that I'm saying this is right, but if some people are saying that this is wrong, then there's really something that is not right. But what we know is that in South Africa, the health situation is not good at all. Something needs to be done to make sure that that's good health care is right.
Chairperson, what do you want me to say? I said, now, Chair, I think that my understanding of the line of questioning is that the department has presented to the committees, and the committees are perhaps looking for clarity. I agree with you that in our opening comment, we did indicate that the minister had said that people would have the opportunity to discuss this policy once the green paper was tabled. Now the green paper is there now for comment. But I think that what people are trying to do in this house, I agree with you that some questions might have gone to, or may not belong to this discussion. And I also agree with you that the department will respond to those questions that they think that there are clarity and they would like to respond to. And also maybe assist, so that we can assist the process. In fact, having said that my understanding, you know, your English is my yeah, maybe we help. Yeah. So you talk about the re-engineering, you know. But you know, when I was looking at this I was thinking about this word of re-engineering. I don't know the difference between re-engineering and re-inventing. You know, because clearly sometimes I think the chair is correct to say sometimes this national health to us comes, and maybe it is the way the presentation is in giving the impression that there is nothing that is functioning today. But I think that the presentation is saying we have a system, but there are challenges on this system. And I think
think that is trying to identify what those challenges are. Then if there are those challenges, the issue, the question may be that we're not asking ourselves. You know, it is easy to point fingers. But sometimes I would really like us as members of parliament to do some our own introspection as people who are charged with the responsibility to do oversight. There are these things that we are seeing that are wrong. We appropriate funds and want to do the responsibility to do oversight. I don't know to what extent are we doing our own oversight to bring this to the attention. The issues that Honourable Members, Honourable Snell, and some other people have said about this, whether it's it is current to the infrastructure that the document is talking about. I'm saying sometimes some of the work, I'm sure it helps that it is there. But the issue then perhaps that gives the kind of key challenges to colleagues here is, if you're talking about 255, I think perhaps we're talking as this is exclusive of the whole, what we call the other things that are there. I think that there are some of the clarities that we need, so that we must spend time. We think that with 255 is something there. I think Honorable Singh did raise this question very, what you call it, obviously. Yeah, in terms of saying, is it 255 over and above what we are spending, or is it within the, what you call it, the system? But I agree with colleagues that says, as parliament, we charge with the responsibility to ensure that everybody else, the poor, the rich, and everyone else has got access to these social facilities. And perhaps the question is, how do we ensure that this happens as efficiently and effectively as possible? And in the role that you play, maybe the parliament will play a role on the on dealing with the green paper that is there, and maybe it will also assist to check up our own, what you call the roles, that's in terms of oversight. I'm not saying that there's no oversight, but sufficiently. For instance, National Treasury, the department speaks about your expenditure review. I think expenditure review is different from the expenditure trends that National Treasury normally publish you. Whether it's for provincial, whether it's for municipalities. And by the way, are we going to get it this year? And I hope that we'll get a date of this. Recently, when is it going to be launched? Because that document normally has a very, what you call, a useful information, very detailed information about what is happening, where, what are the shortages. I don't know, I think that you may comment.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Honourable Members. Perhaps what I'll do is respond specifically to some of the questions and give them some general comments, and some of the questions will be responded to by Dr. Pili. Chair, we had an allocation, and I think within the MTV, next stage is 110 billion. This is what is the appropriate between the provinces and national health. And what we are saying, Chair, for that appropriation, if I may remind honorable members, when the minister was signing the basic budget speech, he actually gave the breakdown of how much was allocated for improvement of health services, including quality that the other members referred to. I think that appropriation was in those allocations actually in recognition of the system failure. And unless we recognize that we have system failures, we will never correct it. And that is the first. And the second was in recognition of the burden of disease. Unless we recognize that we have a burden of disease, maternal and child health, Chair, South Africa, despite its resources, is among the six countries that have shown not to be performing very well as it pertains to maternal and child health. We looked at the data as of 2008. The trend between 2008 to 2010, Chair, if you look firstly with the intervention, prevention of mother to child transmission, there's actually a downward trend. So it means that it's a definitive case of where you intervene and actually say, like, you can reduce the burden. We're also beginning to see a trend. And this report we got from independent experts, local and international, that shows that there's actually a slight improvement in life expectancy since the introduction of antiretrovirals, since we started treating people. That data will be released, as I speak. There's a telephone conference between NRC and some of the experts locally and internationally. I'm just trying to show that those trends are indicative. But the problem, Chair, that we have is that we have a high diversity. Latest data shows that if we treat people early, we can actually reduce transmission rate significantly by 96%. Now, if you are going to change your threshold from 200 to 250, which is what was recently announced, or even to 500, that means that you are going to put more people on treatment. That means you are going to have to allocate more money. But the problem that we have is that you are actually increasing the risk and the burden. So it means you must put not only funds into the system, but you must bring competent people. Chair, the issue of the number of health workers that we have, and I would like to refer to what the Chair said, the Honourable Member said. It's not an issue of management. It's an issue of planning in a country. You plan for your workforce across. You don't plan for the public sector only. You look at the skills that you have in the country to respond to the health problems that you have. I'm saying today, Chair, if you look at the numbers that you have, if you go to the sector council and ask them to give you a register, it's a regulatory issue that I'm talking about. You go to the statutory council, the health professions council, the pharmacy council, the nursing council, ask them how many nurses you have in the country. They will give you a number, but let me tell you, Chair, today, your nurses that are in Saudi Arabia, your nurses that are in the UK, in Canada, in Australia, still register. They still register. So if you go to the register, they appear on the register, but they are not in the country. Your doctors who are business people today, who are in the mining business, who are in the BE business, they still reflect as registered because they pay their registration fees. I don't know about parliamentarians, Chair. I would vouch that some of the parliamentarians still maintain their registration. Now, if you go back to those numbers give you a reflection. They give you a reflection that is for so many professionals, but they're not interested. So, what we are appealing for is that let's go and clean up those registers. The register must say, doctor who is no longer practicing, he's just a business person. This is a doctor who is in Australia. So what we need is that kind of thing. So that as we plan, we know from what perspective we're working on. And I think this is where we'd like to start to. And what we've done is that we're going to work with the Secretary Council. That's to sit and sort out those numbers. Clean up. Equally, would like to go back then and reconcile that with our paper. This is the first problem. The second one, Chair, in this country, for the past 17 years, the number of doctors that are produced annually has not changed. It has not changed despite the burden of disease, despite the increased need. It has not changed. So the question is, how can you correctly and accurately and appropriately respond when you produce exactly the same number, 1,200 doctors per annum? And in the process, the 1,200 that you produce annually, some of them leave the country. They go to Australia, they go to the UK. Your community service, you lose 23% of your community service doctors. They're not retained in the public sector. For your registrar post, and we thank Treasury, because we've gone back to Treasury to say, and as part of what the Minister of Finance referred to earlier in the budget speech, this country is going to run out of specialists in future, because on annual basis, you have a vacancy rate of about 1,200 specialists. And the implications of that, Chair, are that for the 1,200 that you have, you're actually creating a gap. One is that your educators, your professors who produce your specialists and your medical students are aging. Now, you don't have a replacement strategy for those numbers. So what you need is that you take the number of your specialists, because your registrar posts are posts for training specialists. But what you do, you actually use those posts and you retain people. Now, your model of training specialists is actually inappropriate, because you create a post in the public sector for training specialists. Now, if your specialists, those registrars do not pass for whatever reason, they're on a post, they don't have to leave. Now, what it does, it blocks, it actually blocks your entry process of other specialists that you need. So you need to remodel that. So what you've done, we've gone back to work with the Health Professions Council to look at the best model of training registrars. One is that you need to have designated hospitals. If you use a central and a tertiary hospital, then you say you'd like to use these for the training of your specialists, and you make funding available, and you say, if you spend 3 years and you have not completed your coursework and you've not done research and you've not completed your clinical work, then you have to finish it some other time, that you need to vacate this post so that we get other trainees on board who are registered. So what is done, we've gone back to the middle. Part of what we're doing with this strategy is to project future numbers so that our academic institutions can be prepared. When we spoke to the deans of the faculties of medicine, in the meeting with the minister today, and the College of Medicine, we asked them the question, why is it that in this country we produce the same number of doctors? The response, Chair, was that it's because they want to maintain their standards. So the question is, what are those standards that should be maintained that undermine the very fact that we have to respond to the burden of disease in this country? There is no way you can match a standard to the fact that we need to reduce the burden of disease. Someone, that need must be matched with quality. And in addressing quality, what is it that is additional that needs to be done to ensure that there's appropriate funding, but also things that can help us increase the numbers that are needed? And these are the discussions that are underway. Now, what we've done to try and address that specific issue was to go to Best University. We said, okay, let's take those students who come from previously disadvantaged communities. And as a start, on a pilot basis, include 40 of those. So VET has taken on board 40, and we're waiting Treasury approval just for this project. And over a period, see whether other institutions can do that. Victoria University has said that we need additional infrastructure to expand. KZN Nelson Mandela School of Medicine has also said that they are willing to go and increase the number. So, just as a subject, you have to start somewhere so that we increase the number of doctors that we need in the country. There's another option. What you do, you don't train doctors. This country does not have doctors. You just go to Libya, to Iraq, and so on, and you recruit doctors from there, and they provide services. Is that what this country wants? I don't think so. And I think those are the issues that we're trying to address in this strategy set. So say, let's project, let this country compete, because the training of health personnel, it's not that just about the rendering of services, it's about innovation, it's about research and development. And Chair, if I may remind honorable members, it is in this country, it is in this country where we have the best heart transplant. And it is in this country where we should be able to get a solution for our HIV. Chair, I would like to raise a few other problems. If you look at the manner in which you are proposing this, and I would like to go back to what our honorable member said about a special taxing for the HIV. Because this is such a huge project. We are persuaded, Chair, that we really need this task team. And this task team should include people with ethics that are going to look at ethical issues, their rights. We need lawyers. We need people who are going to look at financing. We need to have a whole lot of access to assistance. But I wanted to raise one particular issue, Chair. An honorable member said this is not about innovative financing. And I would like to mention that I happen to be chair responsible in my past role in WHO to be leading a team that was looking at R&D financing and looking at innovative financing mechanisms for research and development for drugs. Because it was on the basis of which we were saying that the research and development for drugs is only focusing on drugs that specifically address diseases of the developed countries. And on the basis of which we think that we need to come up with innovative financing that can help us address problems that disproportionately affect developing countries. And we were part of a team that worked with the Director General of Health as well as Minister Gordon Brown. Ex-Prime Minister Gordon Brown actually set up a team to look at innovative financing for health system strengthening. Now, there are different options that are listed. And health is what our special group said as well. One is that if you look at Unit 8, which was established by France, Norway, Brazil, Chile, and other countries, they created EcoTech as an innovative financing mechanism. Now, the reason they introduced EcoTech was to say there aren't enough funds around.
Airport tax.
As a solidarity scheme.
Okay.
And they're using that as a basis of funding HIV AIDS for these developed countries. There's also GAVI. South Africa has participated in the GAVI. It involves 20 countries. It's another innovative financing mechanism by which you use bonds. There's a proposal at the moment, Chair, of looking at transaction tax to see whether you can look at that as an innovative thing. I'm just saying there are different mechanisms that are innovative by which we can fund it. That brings in additional funding for whatever health problems we have. But we start from the premise that changed. Before you even go back, we want first to go back and run the trial to understand within this pot of funds that we have, it might as well be that we start by redirecting some of the funds, but we need to change the model of health service delivery. And this is, Chair, what we are seeing with re-engineering. It's re-engineering because we've been talking about primary health care since Alma Ata, Chair. So the question is, what is it that we'll be doing this kind of fund and what will change? And it's this proposal that we're putting up front. Children at every learning phase, in practice, we never pick up their learning disabilities until they're at school and they cannot perform. When we intervene at that level, we're not intervening for health. treatment. It's also about the its development, and it's also about the performance of schools for future years. So this primary healthcare approach is to intervene at every day to prevent and promote health. And this is what we're proposing, Chair. So I can go on and on. Let me give Dr. Peter a chance.
Dr. Peter.
Thank
you.
I think just some specific questions. The budget that's proposed in the, in the table, the one that we communicated is indicative and an estimate which we'll provide from time to time as we get more information, includes the public health sector budget as well. So it's full up, includes everything that potentially it could cost us. I think in terms of the issue around social solidarity, and I think the question was asked is, well, people are paying a tax through the taxation system, so why should we pay an additional tax? Through the general taxation, individuals have paid for these taxes for a range of services. South Africa, I think Mark can correct me, that are 11.5% of our government expenditure goes in healthcare. And the question we've asked ourselves is whether 11.5% is an adequate amount of money to be spending on the cost of healthcare in the country. And it also goes to the question about what is social solidarity. If you apply the international understanding of it in healthcare, the understanding is that citizens contribute towards some sort of tax, which goes into a fund that's dedicated to healthcare, where all of them then benefit out of, and government obviously provides an allocation in the system, as opposed to a system where one says that you use a general taxation, that's the only solidarity of the population. The other question was asked ourselves, if we leave the current system to continue, we have the public sector and we have the private sector. In the private sector, we have medical schemes. In the medical schemes, the extent to which social solidarity happens is very limited. People belong to particular benefit options. There is no cross-subsidy between the young and healthy and the sick and old. There is no cross-subsidy between the wealthy and the rich. These are all little pools of money that are sitting around. This tries to bring all of it together to say that we need to manage this cost of healthcare as a society to by one central fund. So it's not about saying that we want to take people's money away from what they contribute to medical schemes, they put it to this fund, and we want to take the money away. It's about saying, how much does healthcare actually cost for South Africa? What's a reasonable amount of money? And how can we effectively balance? And those of us then can pay, how much can we pay? Now, the benchmark of that, obviously, is how much are we currently paying. So we don't want to put people into a situation where they're paying more than what they're currently paying. So that's the purpose of being the benchmark. In terms of the medical scheme's existence side by side with NHI, our understanding is that when NHI is fully implemented, many of the private providers would participate in the NHI system. And our engagements with them today suggest that they're willing to participate. So, if you're receiving the same care that you receive from the same provider that you receive in your medical scheme, I would have difficulty understanding why would you want to pay again into another fund to get the same access to the same provider. The only reason you may want to do it is where you want a particular benefit, for example, plastic surgery, that maybe the NHI may not provide for cosmetic reasons the way you want to address plastic surgery. So those are the kinds of things that we see happen when NHI is fully
Chair, maybe I can also raise a few things. The first one about access and the fact that everyone has access. Perhaps maybe the question that you want to ask is, I mean, is it fair that people do not have a choice? And I want to use a very practical example. If you live in Molizane, in Soweto, the next available clinic is in Tladi, so you have to take a taxi to go to Tladi. But between Tladi and Molizane, there are probably about 3 to 4 or 5 GP practices. If you have medical aid, you can choose between all those 4 and 5 between Tladi and Molizane. But if you don't have what you call universal access, it means you can never go to this unless you pay out of pocket. And perhaps it's a principle that we have to think about. Do we want ordinary South Africans to those duties just like other people? And if so, how do we do it? In a manner that is applicable and such that it can help us reduce the diseases. And perhaps those are some of the debates we should have. The next point, Chair, that I'd like to raise about quality. You see, there are two aspects of quality. There are these six priority areas. We call them core quality standards. These are principles that ordinary members of the party complain about on a regular basis, of cleanliness, long queues, and so on. But there are other quality issues that relate to clinical excellence and governance. Now, clinical excellence and governance is not what an ordinary South African who goes to a doctor will talk about. They will never be able to say, you prescribe this medicine, and if you calculate the quality of life for that patient, they're not going to be able to do this. But it's that technical level of detail that we'd like to introduce to be able to say whether are we introducing quality or not. Part of the reason we went out to do audit, and you're going back to work with provinces to improve quality check, is because when the Office of Standard Compliance is established, which the honorable members so correctly referred to, if you look at the current law in terms of the National Health Act, that Office of Standard Compliance is actually officials in the department. Now, it's almost like you're a referee and a player. You play, meaning as part of the act as it exists, you must go and inspect yourself and say you are doing well. That's how it is. What is different here, we say it must be an independent board that can then hold the Department of Health accountable. And that will ensure that we meet those standards of quality. And those standards of quality should also be measured by how we perform from a clinical perspective, to say we are reducing the burden of disease indeed. And these are the procedures that are acceptable in terms of the standard protection. So I think it is for that purpose. And we're hoping that this is how it will be viewed by the Parliament. As to how the pilot should be, we firmly believe, Chair, that we need to put a proposal that will bring on board different aspects, and we'll be working with Treasury to look at how we'll do this. Our view at this point in time is that we already have capacity through GEMS and other institutions to help us to see how best the funds should be structured. At the same time, we have to ensure that our district can perform. Honourable Member asked, why are we having a central fund and also a district health authority? The view that you hold is that we can't have both a patient and a provider residing in one entity. We need to separate those. We've looked at other models in other countries. The UK, for instance, it works best that way, where you separate the funder as the provider and the patient. Chair, the question on the state pharmaceuticals, this one is outside our mandate. It's the work that the Department of Trade and Industry and Science and Technology are involved in. It's outside our mandate. It's not within the frame of health. What we do, we determine demand. And other departments must establish what the supply is. And they should ensure that they make available the supplies that are needed for us to respond to health. Well, Chair, in the work that I did an analysis of a technology transfer for both developed and developing countries, south, north, south. And in the models that we've looked at, is that when you do tech transfer and you look at local production, it actually makes different people to different people, differences to different people. For those who are policymakers, tech transfer and local production means one thing. For the industry, it means something else. For regulators, it means exactly different things than in that way. So our view is that as health, because you're going to purchase this product, we can't be involved in tech transfer. You have science and technology, you also have trade and industry. And those are Department of Leadership take leadership in those areas.
I think the question around there's a gap between what the public health sector budget will be and what the NHI will cost and how will the gap be fixed and how where will we find the money. That's a question that we're working with Treasury on, because it's not our expertise to identify these are the sources and this is how you must tax people, or these are the other sources of their income, etc. So we've agreed that that's something we must agree on, what the final cost of it, because these are indicative as of indicated. As we sit now, this is what we estimate the cost will be. But when we get closer to the point of implementation, we become more certain about those costs, etc. We will then identify what those sources are going to be. And Treasury is probably better equipped than us to say, well, this is the balance between taxation, other sources of revenue, and there are various sources. The DG, for example, spoke about airline taxation, etc. So Treasury has other ideas about how they can get to raise the funds. They will support us in terms of trying to achieve this. I think the question around how are the $255 billion calculated? We basically looked at what is the cost of delivering the health service currently with the reasonable norms and standards in order to have a reasonable number of patients managed by a doctor at a facility, clinic, at a hospital, at a tertiary, quaternary level, okay? And so basically what you call a bottom-up cost, using the public health system cost to do that, but adjusting it for the norms of what we consider to be realistic. Bearing in mind that currently we don't have all of the human resources that we'd like in order to deliver that. So if we put all of those costs in, this is what our estimate is as to what it's going to be. So the point that I think the DG made earlier is that it's indicative, and after we find the information from the pilot, we will readjust these figures so that we can come to something which is more closer to the answer. The other point I should make is that, you know, we've been discussing with many countries of the NHI who are at the point that we are now, wanting to implement an NHI or to attempt to cost what it's going to be. And every one of them has said, whatever answer you come up with will be wrong. None of us have ever been able to get it there. It's dynamic and iterative, and you need to keep going at it, understanding what are the risks, and what's going to blow your budget, what measures are you going to take to keep that risk control, etc. So it's as much about the number as it is about what measures one takes in order to manage that risk. Because the risk is limited in terms of how that risk is around the thing. So you need to think about all of those things to deal with the treasury about how you do it.
The figures of 255, is that today's terms or 2025?
It's real terms. Real.
Meaning?
It includes the
non financial cost. Yeah?
It includes inflation.
Today's terms. Thank you very much. That's what I wanted to know. Thank you. Thank you.
I don't know about that. There are some specific questions that were asked which have not been responded to, whether they are going to be viewed on them. One of the questions was the budget, the current budget for preparation, and another budget for the pilot phase.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not going to try and give a comprehensive input now. Now, I think we will, in due course, need to make, you know, quite a number of much more comprehensive inputs. I just really want to make a few points. We were also not asked, of course, to prepare any presentation yet. I just really want to just make a couple of points. I want to thank the DG for the presentation, the honourable members for that, the important questions. You know, I think there's no question this is one of the most major policy issue that has faced our country in a very long time. And it's something we're all going to be grappling with for, you know, a long time. There's going to be a lot of meetings and a lot of processes. So, you know, something we're going to be engaging in again and again on. I think firstly, let me just say that, you know, I think there comes a time, you know, where I make these major policy decisions, you know, every 10 or 20 or 30 years, where I look at, you know, what is really the distant future that you see. And you know, if one looks at advanced country systems in terms of health financing, you know, there are really three main options that countries face. The one is what's called the National Health Service, which is what the British, you know, the British top system is. The one is like the US system, which is effectively a kind of private medicine form. And the third is some form of social and national insurance. Those are the three kind of forms that you get, you know, in advanced countries. And as South Africa becomes wealthier over many, many decades and years, the question is which of those three directions do we want to head into? Now, looking at the American system, the U.S. system, you know, it's a very expensive system and not very terribly efficient. And that's why even the Obama reforms are attempting to reform the U.S. system. The main difference, Chair, between a national health service and a national health insurance, to my mind, probably the key major difference is in a national health service, the providers are predominantly public. Whereas in a national health insurance, over time you increasingly use, as the DG says, some private doctors, some private forms of provision in the system. So if you look at Australia or Canada, for example, citizens funded through the public system are able to make choices between public provision and private provision. And I think we have to ask ourselves over the long term, 20, 30, 40 years, do we want only a public provision system or do we want some kind of mixed provision system? And if one's going to look over the long term at a mixed provision system, you know, that is more compatible with a social or national health insurance. Chair, I hope I'm not speaking too long, but I want to then go on to say that if one looks at slide 21, which several members have talked about, you know, how does one proceed across these three axes? This axis of coverage, this axis of co-payments, and this axis of benefits. Now, Chair, typically the way national health insurance has developed in many, many other countries is it's evolved first along the it's evolved more gradually along the coverage arm, in the sense that many other countries have gone the route into national health insurance via social health insurance, which is through gradually increasing coverage in employee groups. It's a very common way of embarking on national health insurance, of eventually moving towards national health insurance. In the South African case, and in certain other cases, certain other country examples, such as in Eastern Europe after the fall of communism, for example, there was a somewhat different approach, which is trying to move more rapidly on the coverage side, but then more gradually on some of the other sides. So, Chip, it's impossible really to go overnight from this small box to the big box. You can't give universal, so these are the things. You can't give universal coverage, comprehensive benefits, no user charges, full access to private hospitals, etc. overnight. It's just not possible or affordable. And I think this is what government grappled with for a very long time. And so really the process that we face over the coming period, and that this is partly why the Green Paper talks really about a 14-15 year transition period. It's really a process of how do we progressively strengthen a system which in this case the policy a preference which is being expressed by cabinet and others is to be able to cover the poorest of the poor from the beginning. But Chair, this cannot be done overnight. And if one's looking and the Green Paper talks about a 15-year period and also lays out three phases, of which the first five-year phase is a lot of it is focusing on strengthening the public sector. The middle phase of 5 years, a lot of it is beginning to pilot contracting with private providers such as general practitioners, with the maturing phase in the third period of 15 years. So, Chair, you know, I think what the challenge that we as officials and technocrats are being asked to really is how do we make a very complex policy, how can we make this feasible? And I think that's the challenge that we face to meet the request that is on us. How do we bring to you as parliamentarians and others a potential feasible transition route. I do need to say, Chair, and I think Dr. Pillay has laid out quite clearly, that in a sense the questions around, some of the questions around financing that have been posed to Health Department are a little unfair, because I think Dr. Pillay is completely correct that these are functions of the Minister of Finance and the relevant finance committees. So that certainly the Portfolio Committee on Finance has requested the Treasury to within 6 months come back with some options on different types of financing arrangements. And you know that is you know, it falls within the competence of the finance minister and committees, and it's within that domain that you know that those options will need to be explored. National Treasury will in due course you know, bring out, as it normally does, around these types of reforms, a discussion paper to allow for public participation around those. Chair, there are many reasons why it's not possible to establish a national health authority immediately. It would be, in many ways, far too risky to, within a year, to establish an entity through which one channels 100 or 150 billion of public funds. It's really going to take years before such an entity can be fully established. It's for that reason, Chair, that through a transition period, the notion of certain forms of interim funding have been raised, such as potentially a conditional grant. So, as honourable members asked and the DPG responded, you know, the Minister of Finance announced certain measures already in the previous budget to try to support some of these interventions, things like the family health schemes, the maternal and child health specialist support, which are partly linked to the pediatricians and the specialists and obstetricians required in the district teams. But it seems likely, Honourable Chairperson, that the Department of Health and the DG has already told us that will focus in on their budget bids for the next budget round really on these pilots, the NHI pilots. And so that although there is some funding already in the baseline for some of these interventions, it seems likely that over this coming budget period, what we're all going to need to grapple with and in the various committees, Chair, in your money bills amendment procedure and other types of procedures, it seems that that's really the focus from a budgetary perspective over the period ahead. It's really trying to see if we can get these pilots, a set of pilots up and running, which help to explore in a sensible way some of these reforms in a very practical way to try and see how we get them working. These family health team arrangements, these district specialist team arrangements, these school health services, the stronger role for the district authority as a contracting body. But Chair, those are just a few introductory comments. You know, I'm sure there'll be many opportunities for interaction around.
I guess that the issues we have coming, I don't think that just like people are not looking for the second one. If that is the case, teaching. Have you got some patents on?
No, Chair, to say that it's an official time, if you know. We'd like to share with you some of the results from the audit.
Yes.
But also, perhaps, if you give us an opportunity, we are sending teams from October to go and spend time helping public to just improve the service element in terms of the not only service, but also health system issues. So that you can then come back and say, out of so many, we've actually helped these problems of the country. More in a developmental manner, so that as we put in teams, that is teams that can ensure that the services can run.
Thank you very much for this honor. No, there's nothing to say, but I think it has been put very well that this is trying to say what can you do to make sure that companies are happy. And obviously, what is being talked about is something that is being put on the table to say, this is what they think, and then, but we don't know whether this will achieve what they think it will achieve. But what is coming to the fore? What is coming to the fore, which is very clear, is that we seem to be representing different constituencies that are not the same in South Africa. It shows the asymmetry of South Africa in this particular debate. That much as we feel we are one, but we are still not exactly the same. And probably this is one of the things that is going to unite us and make us exactly one South Africa. But this is said that it's not something that is going to happen, it's going to be an event. It's going to take some time. But as we must accept that we need to work around each other so that we can understand, because as we are talking, we're coming from different things and we don't understand. The other one is coming from the corner of the climate with no clinic, and the other one is coming from a place where there's a clinic around the house, and then for 2 years with primary health care, they understand what's happening. But probably this is what is going to be beyond that, it's going to bring us closer to understand each other. I'm hoping that the department, when they do their public hearings, because this is them now, they're not only going to concentrate on certain constituencies and forget the other. Because we are asymmetrical and we need to come by everyone so that we can understand what we feel about this. Thank you.
Well, honourable members, maybe I should start by thanking the department for sharing with us what NHI is about, especially as appropriation. In fact, listening to what Professor Fletcher is saying, it's clear that there's been between ourselves as the standing committee on appropriation and finance, we could try to work much closer so that you don't have situations where you have to department as a student one and the same thing to different committees that do almost the same thing people can do. But we'll closely follow and we'd like to contribute to the processes that have been followed. We really will take in suggestions, especially in the issues that we will be challenging. Maybe to be able to follow with you. I think that Dr. Kokwana was correct to say, as government, at the beginning of this day, the time we agreed that we will establish this national health insurance. But the question was how it was to be done. I think that was the issue, and it's still the issue. I think that one slide that really I find very interesting is the history of where it comes from. Clearly, it's work that has been done over the years. And Professor Fletcher says we're not going to get a precise answer today, except that we will participate in the process so that all of us we make it a success. I mean, if we all agree that we want South Africans of all walks to have access to health, it means that somehow there will be sacrifices. Somehow. We hope that National Trust will be there to manage this process to ensure that it's not implemented painfully, but with little what you call it, differently, if you like. But, honourable members, I'd really like to thank you. This process was really not meant for us to resolve, but it was meant for us to have information and then especially the committee and other, what you call the committee and other ministers, how can we take the process forward. On that note,